Welcome to another episode of Conduct Detrimental, our first episode back from Thanksgiving. Dan Wallach, how was your extended break? You do anything fun?
Yeah, I mean, celebrating Thanksgiving always means extended time off, but I think I took the entire week off, Dan, because I finished teaching a 1 week or 6 day sports betting law and regulation class at the University of Miami. It was intense, like 3 hours a day, and it ended right before the Thanksgiving holiday. So I was fried, and I gave myself a couple of days off before just to recharge, and I just took the weekend off. How was your Thanksgiving?
Thanksgiving is fun when you have two little kids running around. It tends to be more stressful than a normal Thanksgiving, but yeah, it's the best. My office closed Wednesday midday, and then obviously no work Thursday and Friday. So yeah, and then Dan, likewise, I have my New York Law School class winding down. I have one more class. I have to finish my final exam in the next like 48 hours for people.
Does your course change every year? Like my sports betting law class changes. It's like no two courses are the same because this stuff just evolves and it's fluid. And, you know, these new stories emerge that just make you think, well, geez, I need to update the course. Is that happening a lot for you?
Yeah. Well, I've been told the course that I teach, I'm making it more work for myself because I redo the syllabus every year, but almost every class, because if there's current events that come up, stuff that we cover on the podcast that I'm in the weeds with, I say if it comes up in class, either in the class, we spend about 15 to 20 minutes talking about current events. So I say if it comes up in class, you could be responsible for in the exam. I'm less concerned with every nook and cranny of the reading and more concerned with what comes up in class. But Dan, to that point, the textbook doesn't change. What changes are the events. So I'm constantly rewriting finals, rewriting my syllabus. So I don't know, good or bad, but I think it's more fun that way, but it's certainly more work.
All right. Well, my sports betting class is a nice segue into our topics for today, isn't it?
It certainly is, Dan. This is sometimes we give you guys behind the fourth wall. Dan, this is an eye into two topics that are very near and dear to what you do in your day-to-day practice. So for our new listeners, Dan is the sports betting guru. He's involved in all facets of the sports betting legal landscape and legislative landscape. So talk about
not the betting. Goals. I don't bet.
Not betting. I'm the betting guy. I do the betting. You just analyze the betting and tell me how many bets I get wrong. But we will save that. So Dan, two stories for today. We're going to talk about the Yasiel Puig betting criminal saga. We're going to bring on Greg Mordock, a Louisiana criminal defense attorney, good friend of yours, return guest of the show. And then separately, Dan, as I'm told, we have a special guest to talk about new sports legislative issues with Captain Jack Andrews. Is that a real person, Dan?
He adopted, you know, Captain Jack Andrews, who is a leading, he's a podcaster, he's a commentator, he's a professional sports bettor. He's so good at it. He teaches others and he advocates on behalf of sports bettors everywhere. Nobody knows this industry from the customer perspective better than Jack Andrews. And I wanted to have him on the podcast today because in the wake of that New York Times article, it was like a 4-5 article investigative deep dive by some reporters I know pretty well, like Joe Drape and Kenneth Vogel, some of the best investigative reporters from the New York Times. In the wake of that article, which, you know, basically scrutinized some of the, you know, practices of the industry from the lobbying side, as well as from the promotional bet side, in the wake of that New York Times piece, a New York lawmaker, a senator, introduced legislation on the last day in November, basically calling out predatory sports betting promotional practices. You know, all those free bets, free deposits, site credits, free money, deposit matching, you know, promotions. He introduced regulation. His name is Senator, New York State Senator Pete Harkin, who introduced a bill that would regulate all the promotional bets under the guidance of the New York State Gaming Commission. He basically wants to rein in the promotional bets that are so commonplace in the online sports betting, you know, ecosystem that the, you know, bettors like, well, people like yourselves and our listeners are going, you know, from site to site and trying to take advantage of the most advantageous, you know, free bet bonuses and deposit bonuses. And he wants to sort of, you know, rein that in and have it regulated, you know, more tightly. So we're going to have Captain Jack on to talk about whether this is a good idea and to basically educate us a little bit more about the sort of the free bet, you know, ecosystem and how that impacts and affects the regulated sports betting industry.
We're going to jump to the topics in a minute. In full disclosure, you and Captain Jack are going to talk one-on-one. Dan, I am in the certainly the legal sports betting space, but as more of a recreational bettor, I don't do work on the sports betting side. I leave that jurisdiction to you. Dan, my betting patterns are really only followed, or I really follow the promotional bets. So I see what DK or what DraftKings, FanDuel, the big sites offer for promotions. And that's usually the only time I'll bet when I think I can get some sort of an edge. So certainly fascinated in that conversation. I know a lot of my my friends, my recreational bettors, and maybe some of my friends that are maybe on the shark side, we'll say, you know, they're interested in that conversation as well. So if you are in the betting space, which I know millions and millions of people now are, I'm certainly looking forward to hearing that conversation.
Yeah, he's a smart guy. Captain Jack's the sharpest guy in the business. If you want to learn, you know, sort of the inside, you know, sort of inside baseball on sports betting as an activity from a professional gambler's perspective. So he's going to be great. I can't wait to talk to him. But of course, you know, the lead story is going to be Yasiel Puig, who, you know, amazingly, over the course of 3 months in his last Major League Baseball season, found the time to get into a brawl, become a naturalized U.S. citizen, and in a three-month period made 900 wagers on professional sporting events. I don't think any of them involved baseball, but he was arrested during the course of an investigation conducted by Homeland Security, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the IRS out of California, and he allegedly made some false statements to the government denying that he made any sports bets or that he knew the informant who had basically turned state's evidence on him. He basically denied knowing anything about this person other than through baseball, and they hit him with felony charges for making false statements under oath, not for the act of actually engaging in betting. And we're going to talk to Craig about the effect of the withdrawal of Puig's guilty plea and what this means for his case going forward.
I think the reason that we kind of harped on Puig, in addition to having, you know, obviously the sports betting tie-in, you know, there were reports that surfaced really about a year ago today in 2021 that Puig was accused of sexual assault really towards the end of 2017 and 2018. So, Dan, you know this, I'm a San Francisco Giants fan, but I see a lot of, or at least at one point when Puig was a member of the Dodgers, I would watch a lot of his games. And I was really curious how a guy, you know, maybe he was never like the top upper tier of talent in Major League Baseball, but I'm just going to read off some numbers. People don't know Yasiel Puig, you should, former All-Star. But his playing career ended at the age of 28. And you would say, how did that happen? Did he have some crazy allegations back then? Well, no. And he was still relatively productive. He was basically a 2020 guy, 20 home runs, 20 stolen bases, you know, with a near 800 OPS his last 3 years, and played for some pretty competitive teams. So, you know, I've always had this mystery, like, why was Yasiel Puig kind of blackballed from baseball? Was it because of the sexual assault allegations? Possible. But this story seems to be, again, we're not in the art of speculation here, but it might give us some indication as to why this very talented player in his 20s, in the prime of his career, all of a sudden was no longer part of the Major League Baseball fraternity. So I found the story to be very interesting. And, you know, obviously, Dan, when the plea popped across my radar, I found that noteworthy. You and I were planning on covering it. And then when the plea is withdrawn, now we really have to take a deeper dive and explain to our audience what it means to make a plea to withdraw it and how that's going to impact his prosecution of his case. So, Dan, you wrangled in a fantastic guest, Craig Mordock, for the show. Anything you want to add before we turn it over to our interview?
Sure. But on a broader level, I think this got me to focus on the federal investigation taking place in the Central District of California. They're looking at, you know, this illegal betting operation conducted by a former minor league baseball player and major league prospect by the name of Wayne Nix. And apparently he used some offshore website and recruited scores of retired and current professional athletes to make wagers through his operation and offshore. So this is, potentially, this could become a terrible optical issue for Major League Baseball, because we don't know where this investigation, where it's going to lead, if it's going to end soon, and what other athletes are going to be ensnared in this three-tiered investigation that involves three separate federal governmental agencies. I mean, when you think of the U.S. Attorney's Office, the IRS, and Homeland Security, this sounds like a very far-reaching investigation. When you hear plural around professional athletes, you're wondering, when's the other shoe going to drop? What other athletes besides, you know, Puig are going to be named as defendants, or it will come out that current professional athletes made scores of wagers while they were playing their sport, and maybe they even bet on their own sport. So this is now a story that I'm going to keep my eye on going forward, because I can't imagine that they devoted all this energy just to get Yasiel Puig on a false statement. There's got to be more to it.
Yeah, I guess it's a good place to end it. Craig's obviously a fantastic guest. Before we kick it over to Craig, our podcast is sponsored by Themis Bar Review, top bar prep company in the galaxy. You might be thinking, why are we talking about bar prep in December? Because it's always bar prep season. There's always special deals. Maybe guys, for the holiday season, give someone the gift of Themis Bar Review. Use our promo code CONIC for a special discount code, or just reach out to us on one of the social platforms, or if you can find my email somewhere, congrats to you. And I will hook you up directly with our Themis special discount. So again, let's move directly over to Craig, who is a wealth of knowledge in everything and everything criminal law, and obviously a huge sports fan. So I certainly love that.
He's the real deal, Dan. He's a real deal. It's a thrill to have him on.
Without further ado, let us kick it over to Craig Mordock.
I'd like to welcome to Conduct Detrimental, New Orleans-based criminal defense attorney with significant experience representing, you know, pro athletes, experienced in state court, federal court. Welcome to our podcast back again. I think we've talked before during the Periscope era. Craig Mordock.
Hi, Dan.
Nice to catch up with you again. I saw some of your tweets on the Yasiel Puig withdrawal of his guilty plea. What do you make of all this and the case in general against Puig? I mean, he's not accused of engaging in illegal sports betting. So what's going on here?
It is a very curious case, to say the least. He is charged one count of 18 U.S.C. 1001, which is lying to the federal government or making a material false misstatement to the federal government. We pled guilty to that. And when you plea in federal court, it is, I don't know if some people have seen state court pleas, but a lot of times it's wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, get off the stage, you're guilty. In federal court, they outline and go through a series of questions, and it takes about 45 minutes to execute a plea in federal court. Puig most likely had an interpreter for that, and he obviously had criminal defense counsel because it sounds like this was all negotiated in advance. He was pleading guilty to a felony, and he was paying a $55,000 fine. And there was no prison time. I think it was 2 years or 3 years probation, maybe, but there was no prison time attached to it. It was just pay the fine. The momentum started to build here about how Puig sort of doesn't think he's guilty, thinks he was entrapped, and he withdrew the plea yesterday, which you can do in federal court. It's much easier to do in federal court than it is in state court. And he said that, you know, he did not have a criminal defense lawyer. He did not have his own interpreter when he was interviewed. And those are the basis for withdrawing the plea. Although you can withdraw a plea in federal court anytime up until sentencing. It's up to the judge. But again, like I said, it's much easier to do in federal court than it is in state court, or at least state court in Louisiana.
Is there any repercussion from withdrawing your guilty plea? Is any aspect of the plea agreement admissible? Lay out, are there any adverse consequences by basically changing your mind and withdrawing?
Absolutely. The plea agreement, the factual basis that he admitted to when he pled guilty, and the fact that he pled guilty are all admissible against him in a trial on the 101 charge. So essentially, the feds are going to say, you lied to us then, and or did you lie to us when you pled guilty? Like, he's either lying then or he's lying now. And either way, he is guilty of some falsehood or material misstatement. And that's why I think the feds didn't really object to him withdrawing the plea, but, you know, vigorously. I mean, I read the quote from the U.S. attorney, and I mean, I've been involved in a couple withdrawal pleas, not in federal court, in state court, and they're usually pretty contentious. And the U.S. attorney in this case was like, yeah, whatever, it's fine. And I think they kind of know they might have them. But then you look at the reasons for the withdrawal of the plea, and which he said, you know, this is a guy who is a non-English speaker or a non-native English speaker. I think his English sort of flows depending on who he's, you know, his English gets good when it needs to be good. It's not as good. The other thing I had not considered was whether Puig had some immigration issues, but he became a U.S. citizen in 2019.
Ironically, during the time, the three-month period in which he placed 899 bets, he found enough time to get traded twice, to get into a brawl during a game, to get suspended, and to become a U.S. citizen at the same time he's making 899 bets. So that's probably one of the most active periods of Puig's, you know, baseball career, right?
I don't think he hit too much during that, but he definitely, I wonder what his percentage on the bets were. The issue, I think, is he's playing baseball in South Korea and he had played baseball in Mexico. And I suspect that maybe federal probation, again, I don't know this is me speculating, told him that playing baseball in a foreign country while on federal probation was a non-starter. I think that might be part of what the basis is, because I, again, as a pro athlete who's made millions of dollars, you're paying a $55,000 fine. I mean, there's no jail time attached to the plea. I don't quite understand, you know, what the incentive is for him to do this. And I mean, honestly, if you're withdrawing the plea, the prosecutor is going to argue very vociferously for jail time if he is found guilty at trial.
Well, here's the weird thing, Craig. I mean, I was reading the guilty plea, and it has a certification of the defendant's attorney basically witnessing this guilty plea, saying that based to the best of my knowledge, the factual basis set forth in this agreement is sufficient to support my client's entry of a guilty plea pursuant to this agreement. So now, a couple of months later, this same attorney, or at least the agent, it wasn't this attorney, the agent is starting to offer up a panoply of reason why, you know, you can withdraw your guilty plea, but they're now beginning to lay the foundation or the groundwork for why his Zoom interview earlier in the year shouldn't be taken seriously. He was rushed. He was unprepared. He didn't have his own interpreter, didn't have his own criminal defense attorney. He's a product of authoritarianism in Cuba. He has mental health struggles. He has ADHD symptoms. Where are they going with this kind of miscellaneous, you know, sort of approach?
I think they're going to say when he met with the feds, he did not understand the consequences of what he was saying to them. He didn't understand. I mean, I think they're going to say there was a language barrier. He probably didn't understand what rights he was giving up. He didn't understand your right to remain silent. If it was a Zoom interview, I don't know how the waiver of rights form was executed, but that would be a question I would have, is whether they made him sign a waiver of rights form or whether they just read him his rights over the Zoom. The other thing that's pretty interesting about the way the federal government conducts investigation is the FBI does not record interviews. So there's no written recordation of this. What they use is a document called a 302, which I'm sure some of you have heard about with regard to some of the Trump investigations and things like that. And the 302 is generally treated as gospel by the feds, the prosecutor, and the court. And that's a written record of what the agent did, what the interviewee said. And if something's wrong in the 302, good luck trying to get it corrected later on. So that could be part of it, is, hey, there's more to what's on the 302 here than what meets the eye. And you left out certain things. Certain things were not clear to Yasiel. And therefore, you know, we don't know whether he's actually, you know, whether he actually did in fact make a material misstatement.
Craig, I had this kind of thought. I'm watching, you know, I'm looking at Yasiel Puig's baseball reference. Obviously, we largely know him from his tenure with the Dodgers, but, you know, you guys addressed it, right? These bets occur at a period of time where he's actually in Major League Baseball. I'm not sure everybody really knew that right away. He's been out now for a couple of years. So he plays, you know, 2019, he splits time between the Reds and the Indians. In that last half of 2019, he has a pretty impressive slash line, right? I mean, tie this back to sports a little bit. He hits 297 with a 377 on base and a 423 slugging. And at the time, he's only 28 years old. He ends up going to play in some foreign leagues, and it has some pretty impressive numbers. Do we have any indication one way or the other that Major League Baseball was aware, or any teams within the league were aware of these allegations as they were occurring? Because otherwise, it seems odd that he's not playing in 2020, 2021, 2022.
I do think that is very strange. The idea that you have a guy who, and I think he made the playoffs with Cleveland that year as well, who was a valuable part of a playoff team. And then all of a sudden he's playing baseball in Mexico and then South Korea. And he was an extremely popular player. I mean, everybody liked the guy. It does seem odd that Major League, you know, that either he was blackballed because of rumors of gambling, or even if there's an unannounced suspension or something like that, it definitely raises a red flag and may explain why he's not in Major League Baseball currently.
Obviously, you know, we're not in the business of speculation, but I'm not aware of a player with a profile like this. And obviously Puig has some other legal issues. You know, there's some sexual assault claims that transpired with respect to Puig, but still we've seen players, right, get other chances in the league. And we can talk about Deshaun Watson, who has his own allegations of playing in the National Football League. He's going to be returning this week. But yeah, I mean, obviously it's a taboo of all sports to be betting on baseball while you're in it. Just ask Pete Rose. It would seem, right, that maybe Major League Baseball had some indication that this was happening. Otherwise, it's tough for at least me to make sense of how he's not back in the majors at any point. Not to make light of any of the allegations, but, you know, we've seen other players, you know, of lesser stature make it back to the league.
Yeah, I agree. It definitely raises a red flag as to whether the Major League Baseball knew, or teams had wind of this, or teams had wind of an investigation into him And that's why he went to Mexico and then South Korea. It certainly makes one wonder. And again, I guess we can't really speculate because the Major League Baseball has been pretty quiet about this, and which they should be because he's not in the league. So there's no need for them to address it at this point.
Yeah, Craig, given his, you know, record as a sports bettor, you know, he was in the hole, $280,000, made 900 bets in a 3-month period. You pointed out that he wasn't really facing a lot of jail time here. I think it would be up to 5 years maximum. But now that he's withdrawn that guilty plea, he could potentially, under the base offense level for this crime, I think it's larceny, embezzlement, theft of property, whatever, we could be talking about false statements that could land him in jail for a number of years. So how much of a gamble is this decision by Yasiel Puig? Given your background as a criminal defense attorney, what would you be advising him to do?
Again, without being present for that interview where he sat down with the Fed, it's very hard for me to know. But any time that you are charged with a federal crime and you know how difficult it is to win a federal criminal trial, you're walking out of there paying a fine and some probation requirements. I mean, I think I'd be telling him, look, dude, count your blessings here, because again, and that's something I think you are alluding to, is he could be reindicted on additional charges here. Now, I don't think we know enough about the investigation to know what they would be, but I think it's pretty likely if you're going to withdraw your plea, the feds are going to want to try and get you on something more than a 1001 charge. And you're right, anything related to the gambling, I mean, it could be taxes. I mean, there certainly could be tax issues. Was he declaring all this? There could be some. I know if you're placing bets, they really do not look at the people placing bets. It's more of a situation where they're running the illegal gambling and taking the VIG, and that seems to be what the real crime is. But yeah, I mean, I think there certainly could be a larceny charge or something like that, depending on the facts of the case. And I think you could see him a superseding indictment filed against him with 4, 5, 6. I mean, honestly, if he's placed 900 bets, that's probably 900 counts there could be.
Yeah, I mean, and the surprising thing to me, Craig, is the non-involvement of the Major League Baseball Players Association. I know he wasn't a member of any Major League Baseball team when he was charged with a crime, but these acts and allegations basically involve his, you know, his tenure while he was a member of the Cincinnati Reds and Cleveland Indians at that time. He could potentially have been giving testimony and giving information about other Major League Baseball players. I mean, this three-agency investigation, it's Homeland Security, the IRS, the U.S. Attorney's Office, they're looking at a wide range of illegal behavior around sports betting and money laundering. And this could potentially sweep up other pro athletes. So I'm surprised the unions weren't apprised of this kind of activity, because I think they should have provided him with the kind of counsel that would have protected his rights during that Zoom interview in January of 2022.
I would suspect if he was out of baseball for 3 years, they may not have caught wind of this. I mean, I think that is certainly a distinct possibility here. But you are right. I mean, in the withdrawal of the plea, they talk about the fact that there are other players involved in the investigation, and that is, you know, and that those players had not been charged as of yet. Again, Puig wasn't charged with gambling; he was charged with a making false statement charge. So, if they were truthful about what they told the feds, then there's no reason to charge him with that. So maybe there's something more coming down the line here. I don't know. And I agree with you that it is odd that Major League Baseball is not trying to contain the situation. It seems like it's kind of blowing up on them, actually.
Craig, thanks for joining us today. This was very enlightening. We'll bring you back on if this story blows up. And as
sure.
A sports law podcast, Dan and I hope it blows up. But
I kind of
end of the road.
I'd like to see something fun here.
Just don't tell Puig's lawyers that. They don't need to.
Well, they get the bill, so.
Where can folks find you on Twitter? I know they can find you at CJ Mordock, but tell us your website, your practice.
Sure. Criminal defense in all the entire state of Louisiana, federal, state, municipal court, strictly criminal defense. I don't do anything else. I've been doing it for 15. I've been defending people for 15 years. I was a prosecutor for about 2. Didn't like putting people in jail. And I'm much better defending people than I ever was at prosecuting people. It's what I enjoy doing. And I like talking about it. And I like trying to educate people about the criminal justice process, because there does seem to be a lot of mystery to it. It's not as clean as, say, a civil lawsuit or something, you know, where people understand hey, these are the, you know, these are the elements to it. I mean, there does seem to be a little bit of, you know, you have to be in it every day to be able to really understand it. So that's, you know, and I have gone to, obviously I was involved in the college basketball situation. So I've gone to New York for a case. I've had a case in the, in Houston as well. So, you know, every once in a while you get to travel, but not often. The Sixth Amendment right to counsel is pretty broad.
Yeah, there it is. The New York contingent of the sports law community of New Orleans, Craig Mordock and Gabe Feldman, yeah, carrying the flag for sports law in the city of New Orleans, right? You're a native New Yorker.
Exactly. So I'm actually from Pennsylvania and lived in Jersey for a while. I'm not a New Yorker, but I identify with the Northeast mentality.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today and kind of giving us some, you know, legal expertise and in particular criminal law expertise around the burgeoning situation involving Yasiel Puig, which we'll, you know, monitor going forward. So thanks for joining us today, Craig. It's a pleasure having you on Conduct Detrimental. We'll have you back soon.
Not a problem, Dan. Thank you, Dan. Thank you very much. It was great to be on.
So that was Craig Mordock. You can find him on Twitter at CJ Mordock, M-O-R-D-O-C-K. Dan, that was a really fascinating conversation. Criminal law is one of the you know, few practice areas that I don't really have any involvement in. I try to refer that work out. I have a family member and uncle who's very big in criminal defense. So it's a lot of where my criminal referrals go. But yeah, I think it's a fascinating conversation. And, you know, obviously, again, we're not in the business of speculation, but Major League Baseball is in the business of trying to sniff out any type of bad optics of gambling. So, Dan, this is my own opinion. I'd be very surprised if this completely went underneath Major League Baseball's radar up until the time that you and I found out about it.
It's hard to predict where this investigation is going to go. But from Puig's perspective, it's a huge gamble he's making. He wasn't going to get much jail time. It was a fine of up to $55,000. Maybe he wouldn't have gotten anything more significant than up to a year in jail. Now what's back on the table could be potentially, you know, a sentence in excess of 5 years. And he's made these statements. He's made these statements undeniably. These statements are part of his plea agreement. He signed it. His criminal defense attorney certified that, you know, everything was on the up and up. And then 90 days later, they're singing a different tune. And I'm wondering whether this is going to come back to haunt him in the end, whether this is another bad beat for Yasiel Puig when, you know, he got away with very limited exposure here in terms of criminal culpability. So maybe Craig is right, Dan. Maybe there's something else that he's trying to protect. And if he's going to have a criminal conviction on his record by way of a guilty plea, maybe there's some other consequence that could impact him professionally or maybe even coming back into the United States. So I guess it remains to be seen. But from Puig's end, I don't think it's a smart move considering what he's already said on the record and agreed to with the presence of not just one attorney, but now two attorneys, one during the interview and now a criminal defense attorney during the allocution. Very surprising to me.
One thing, Dan, that you and I can agree on before we move to our next guest. I mean, Yasiel Puig's still a pretty young guy. He's 31. Everybody loves a good comeback story. I think you and I can agree it is never going to happen for Yasiel Puig. His Major League Baseball career is over.
Well, with a guilty plea, it's over,
I think, Dan, even with the optics that he made that many bets while an active player, I don't think there's any career for Puig in the majors anymore.
Yeah, you're probably right. The statistics aren't awful, but I think for Major League Baseball, they've got to be asking themselves not just what lies down the road with respect to other ball players, but as they begin to now embrace sports betting in a multitude of different states. I mean, my God, teams are now hosting sports books at their stadiums and are even participants in the licenses themselves, like the Arizona Diamondbacks, the teams in Ohio, teams in, you know, the Orioles, the Cincinnati Reds, Cleveland Guardians. They're getting sports betting licenses. They are actual participants in the enterprise. So now this raises the question that wasn't really answered in the sign-stealing lawsuit. And that question is, can the teams themselves, and maybe even Major League Baseball, be held legally responsible for any of these, you know, betting scandals when lawsuits are inevitably brought by disgruntled sports bettors? I think in the sign-stealing case, it was the Second Circuit of the Southern District of New York upheld the dismissal of Major League Baseball based upon the fact that they weren't involved in the bet at all, that their only pecuniary interest was through the indirect benefit of sponsorship deals. But when they're beginning to touch the betting money and they're getting a cut of the betting action directly, I think it's more likely than not that they're going to be kept in lawsuits should there ever be a scandal. And now there's a reprise of that kind of lawsuit because now the teams are profiting directly from legal sports betting. And in fact, in many states, they're license holders and Major League Baseball, by extension, is profiting from the same activity.
I think that's a great point, Dan, and I think a good place to transition here to our sports betting specific topic. And Dan, I'm sure we'll have some comments at the end. But Dan, you sat down with Captain Jack Andrews to talk about some really interesting legal issues, we'll say legislative issues, maybe the future of the sports betting promotional industry. So, Dan, I think that's a good place to end it. Anything to add? Anything to preface before we kick it over to Captain Jack, the other Captain Jack?
I think it's perfect timing to talk about, you know, sports betting promotions, because now that's coming under scrutiny in the wake of this New York Times reporting. And the Massachusetts Gaming Commission is now considering rulemaking to rein in the type of advertising that permeates live sporting events and televised sporting events. So I think this is definitely one of the hot topics in the sort of the current, you know, the current iteration of like the sports betting industry. It's really come under a microscope. So we'll talk to Jack about, you know, where that aspect of the industry may be headed.
Okay, Dan, I think that's a good place to end it. And without further ado, let us kick it over to our conversation with Captain Jack Andrews.
All right. It is with great pleasure we bring you our second guest in our second segment on Conduct Detrimental today, somebody that I've known for a couple of years in the sports betting space. I was his Twitter mentor. I am one of the few people that has impacted the now super popular Twitter account of our next guest, Captain Jack Andrews, one of the most knowledgeable professional sports bettors in the industry. He's an advocate for sports bettors, and he has this great website called unabated.com. And I've been meaning to get Jack on the podcast for quite a while. He's invited me to his podcast and his Twitter spaces, but this is merited because he is the person that I turn to for explaining how the industry works more than anybody else. So Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks, Dan. That was a great introduction. And yes, I appreciate the guidance you gave me to say, get more out there on Twitter, Jack. You have 51 followers. You need to have more followers. And it's springboard from there.
Yeah, I mean, somebody did that to me. Robert Raiola basically gave me the kick in the ass in August of 2004. I had a little bit more than you had at the time, at a whopping total of 198 followers. Here we are, all these thousands of followers later, and you've just outpaced me by like multiples, because there are more people who want to bet on sports than care about sports law, I think. And you're also really good at steering people into the right direction and educating them about how the industry works, which leads to the next topic. In the wake of this New York Times story, this four-parter from Joe Drape and Kenneth Vogel, there's been, you know, the expected outrage, right, from the gambling industry. There's been the I knew it all along, you know, sentiments from people who are critical of the sports betting industry. And then not surprisingly, lawmakers are going to weigh in with some remedial measures. And the first shoe to drop occurred yesterday, November 30th in New York State. A state senator by the name of Pete Harkham, he introduced a bill to regulate these online sports betting promotional bonuses. And his bill it's basically a vague bill that doesn't have any major details other than to direct the New York State Gaming Commission to promulgate regulations covering deposit matching, risk-free betting, free money, free bets, site credits, profit boosts. I don't deal in that world, Jack. I learned a long time ago when I chased my losses during the 1977-1978 NBA season and lost seven successive bets in a row by doubling my bets each time as a 15-year-old until Bill Walton and Maurice Lucas bailed me out barely against the San Francisco Warriors. I had to call up that score on sports phone, King Wally 976-1313, and that quickly squelched my gambling life. So I don't know, from this world of promotional bets and promotional bonuses, I know how they're taxed. I know how they're treated in legislation, but how does it drive and actually impact the sports betting experience from the industry side as well as from the consumer side?
Well, that was a valuable lesson that young Dan Wallach learned by martingaling his way into near financial ruin. Look, sports betting is highly reliant on promotional bonuses. They're a marketing spend, right, Dan? They are something to raise brand recognition. They are something to buy the loyalty of a new player, get them hooked in, and now they're going to be the one or two sports apps that they have on their phone for betting. And it's a good way to, you know, just to buy that long-term loyalty. I don't think bonuses and profit boosts and things like that are a bad thing for the industry. In fact, they're very necessary. It's the muscle that makes DraftKings, FanDuel, BetMGM rise to the top, because they can afford to spend egregiously on marketing. Here's where they can become problematic, is sports books are only going to give additional bonuses out to losing bettors. That just makes more financial sense to them. If somebody on their initial deposit loses all $1,000 of it, the sportsbook may say to themselves, well, every time he comes back here, he'll lose $1,000. We can give him $200 up front and he'll lose that whole $1,200. It's not necessarily smart math because that's not a guarantee, but there needs to be a little bit of protection against consumers being hoodwinked in how they approach the bonuses. And what we saw in New Jersey back in 2018 when they legalized, certain regulations were put in there. They're very ambiguous. If you read the code in New Jersey, it's sort of ambiguous. But one of them says the bonuses cannot have excessive wagering requirements. But excessive is not really termed. It's just an ambiguous term. And we've seen sportsbooks, for the most part, in New Jersey follow in line with that. But then they start to kind of push the envelope. And I've seen that over the past year or two. They continue to push the envelope. The wagering requirements become higher and higher. And something that the sportsbooks are fond of doing is limiting players, right? So you deposit $1,000 at BetMGM, and this is actually a real-life example. You get a $1,000 bonus, and after your first bet of $500, you get limited to $5 on any future bet. And you now have $50,000 of wagering you need to fulfill. You can only bet $5 at a time. You've now kind of just locked up that money. There's no way you're going to get that money out anytime soon. I've advised people to go to the regulator in situations like that, because in my mind, that's excessive. If you have to place 10,000 wagers to clear your bonus, that's a bit excessive. The other thing that we've seen that New Jersey cracked down on early is if you have a withdrawal, you click, you know, make withdrawal, it'll hang there for 24 to 48 hours. And at any time, you can press that big button that says reverse withdrawal. And we saw that some online casinos in New Jersey were incentivizing people to reverse their withdrawal by giving them some kind of bonus on top of the withdrawal amount that was already money that should be in their pocket. And the state came down very heavily on that and said, no way, you can't do that. And I would like to see other states kind of follow that lead. I don't know, Dan, I have not read all the regulations in all the states. You probably have. But I don't think that these have carried over in the blueprint like they have with some of the other regulations.
Yeah, but do we really need a statutory directive to tell the regulators to do their job? I mean, they're carrying out their mandate under state law to regulate and oversee the sports betting industry within their states. Don't the regulators already have the authority to regulate promotional bets, free bets, deposit bonuses without a state lawmaker saying, hey, I think it's a great idea if we have a statute directing the commission to take the matter under advisement? That's really like a non-directive. Don't the regulators already regulate this area through the notion that sportsbooks cannot engage in any false and misleading advertising? Doesn't it fall under that umbrella to begin with?
Absolutely, it does. But as you know, not all of these state regulatory bodies are made the same. We have a spectrum of state regulatory bodies. And at one end, we may have, you know, the New Jersey DGE couched under the office of the Attorney General with state troopers as enforcement agents. At the other end of the spectrum, and I won't throw a state under the bus, but we may have a lottery commission that has really just kept track of scratch cards for the past decade or two. And they're oblivious to what sports betting even is. Yet now they're regulating it.
Jack, to be fair to lottery commissions, they're basically working with single source suppliers. They're putting out requests for proposals and selecting a vendor. In New Hampshire, it's DraftKings. In Rhode Island, you know, Bally's, IGT. There's not a lot of promotional spend in states where there's a monopoly. So who's doing it right besides New Jersey? And what steps, what remedial steps, if you can give me any specifics, if you were going to write the ideal, you know, regulation to govern sports betting promotions, what would you include in it?
I think it has to be a bit ambiguous, just like New Jersey did it, because there's a range of options when it comes to these promotional bonuses, and they're not all bad. You know, if somebody does lose a lot of money, you don't know for certain that that is a lot of money to them. We don't have affordability checks in the US. I'm not in favor of them at all, but it is really up to basic casino marketing morality as to how far they want to push this. And what we've seen from the gaming industry over the years is that if you let them push it too far, they will push it. If you put up some at least barriers that are watch posts that say you can't do this to this extent, they'll abide by them. So look, I'm not in favor of what the New York Times did to the sports betting industry in that article. I'm not in favor of knee-jerk reaction to in suggesting regulations in response to that article. But I am in favor of saying, okay, let's at least have some ambiguous terms that we can say to an operator, we feel like you're pushing the limit here, and this is our barrier that you're butting up against. You know, calm it down a little. And here's the thing about New York, Dan. We know they can't deduct promotional spend, and we've seen promotional spend decrease month over month in New York as they basically, they've used it for brand awareness. They're not really using it for continual player hooks because it's too costly for them with that tax rate and unable to deduct. And we know that other states are going to follow that model of no more deducting a promotional spend or have a cap to it. And I think that's when you start to make the operators choose their promotional spend a bit more wisely and make it less about a spray and pray approach getting new sports bettors in and make it more about targeted for the players that they want to keep under their fold. And then it becomes a question of, you know, are we being open to responsible gaming and problem gaming and things like that when you do the promotional spend?
I want to ask you a last question for the benefit of our listeners. We have an inordinate amount of sports lawyers who love to bet on sports. What advice would you give our audience about how to select and comb through all the avalanche of bonuses that are available across, you know, all these different platforms? How should our listeners shop for the best ones? Is there any advice you could give to basically allow them to understand, you know, the risks as well as the reality behind some of these bonuses?
The short answer is play them all. The sign-up bonuses are almost always a positive EV, a positive expected value play for a new user. That's what they're there for. They're there to hook you in because they think your LTV, your lifetime value is greater than the amount they're giving up for customer acquisition. They used to be so much better, Dan. It used to be 3 years ago, you could come to New Jersey and spend an afternoon and make $10,000 without much risk at all, just because all the promotional signups were that juicy. Now in New Jersey, it's a very saturated state. I would target going to a state that's a little bit more new to the game. The bonuses there will be better. We actually just saw that with Maryland coming online. FanDuel and DraftKings each rolled out a $5,000 free bet offer, meaning your first bet up to $5,000, if it loses, you get that back in free play. That's a great bonus for anyone. It's easy to see that that has value. Even if you can't do it all the way up to the maximum $5,000, it still has value. So shop around, find what's out there. Once you have an account, the bonuses start to be a little bit more pedestrian. Mm-hmm. And it's not as important to find the best ones. And, you know, maybe an odds boost on something happening in a game doesn't really hold much value. It just basically takes away some of the house edge and you go from there. But for the most part, those sign-up bonuses, if you're a new player, especially in a new regulated state like Maryland or Ohio in a month here, they're juicy.
Okay. Can you be limited by the books if you shop around too much for bonuses? Do they flag people who are basically, you know, bonus hoarders? Can they detect that kind of behavior and limit you or cut you off?
Absolutely. Yeah. If you're only playing bonuses and promotions at a sports book, they're going to take action. They're either going to cut you off from being able to play bonuses, or they're going to limit you down so that all of your bets get this kind of insulting $5 limit. It's just one of the things you have to deal with. And the other thing I should make, Dan, is if you're a player in one state, you can't just go to another state and get all the new sign-up bonuses. Everyone uses a shared wallet these days, with the exception of BetMGM and BetRivers. They're the only two that don't have shared wallet technology. So you can't sign up for FanDuel in New Jersey and then go to Ohio and get the juicy bonus come January. It just doesn't work like that.
The practice of sportsbooks limiting or cutting off bettors simply because they're successful. How do you address that? Is that something that could ever be addressed in any kind of consumer protection fashion? Or that's just the nature of the business and sportsbooks should be free to do that and there's really no recourse?
My point has always been, if they're going to do that, they need to declare that up front. And they need to declare that with limits that apply to everyone. And then they can let certain players exceed those limits. So if I were to go to make a bet at DraftKings today, I will not be able to get down more than $3 on anything. I made the example once before. I tried to bet the Super Bowl coin toss at an obvious disadvantage. They wouldn't take my money.
Where do you bet?
They just won't take me for anything. So I would like for them to have to declare the limit for everyone is $5, but you may be able to exceed that, because what that'll do is that'll take the recreational bettor and they'll be able to see that glass ceiling. Mm-hmm. They'll be able to see that, oh, wait a minute, this is the sort of thing that happens in this industry. Because if they do it the other way and they say the limit for everyone is 5,000, but we may limit you to less, then most of the recreational bettors will never see the glass ceiling. So I'd like just somebody to expose that and show that This is how they all operate, just about all of them. There's some exceptions. And, you know, look, you can't advertise on television every 30 seconds saying, winners welcome. We love winners. More ways to win. Win, win, win. If you, we can change your life at FanDuel Casino and Sportsbook, and then not be able to back it up with actually letting you win.
Best sports betting movie of all time.
Sports betting movie. That's tough.
Gambling movie.
I am a sucker for Ocean's 11 just because it shows the back of the house. The back of the house.
The sting?
Yeah, no, that's... You asked for one. You asked for one off the top of my head. Look, there's a lot of good gambling movies out there that have gotten it right. You know, everything from Rounders to The Sting is another great example of what the scene was like. What's the one with George Segal and California Split? That's an excellent movie. A gambling movie shows you the gambling addiction, really. That's what it shows you. It shows you the itch that people need to scratch sometimes. I think that's a great movie. I'm going to go with that one.
All right. When I say the following four names, what do you think of? Speed, Vinny, Murray, and Roy.
What do I think of?
Oscar Madison's weekly poker game on The Odd Couple.
Wow. Oh.
You went one for two. That was your free bet.
Dan, I think you overestimate my age. The Odd Couple was on when I was like homesick from school and the reruns.
Unfortunately, the reruns did not live on forever. One of the greatest, I think, situation comedies in television history. Some of the great shows from the 70s really deserve a re-airing these days. All in the Family, Sanford and Son, The Odd Couple, the list goes on and on. Maybe we'll talk about that next time we meet up in New Jersey during the SBC North American Gaming Summit. But Jack, it was a pleasure having you on today. Thank you for demystifying sort of how sports betting bonuses work and how they benefit the industry, while at the same time, there could be some consumer protection issues surrounding them. So thank you for joining me. I appreciate being on your podcast and Twitter space as well. I definitely want to have you back as my go-to sports betting consumer focused perspective. You're a great guest as always. And thanks for your debut on Conduct Detrimental. It was fabulous.
Thank you, Dan. This was a pleasure. Anytime.
So that was Captain Jack Andrews. Dan, a fantastic conversation. And I think we could put it in the books. Dan, anything to add?
I just think it's like pretty cool that we got to do a sports betting themed episode. I mean, I consider sports betting not a separate topic apart from sports law. It's a subset of sports law. Sports law 10 years ago didn't really include much sports betting. But now, you know, with legal sports betting available in 35 states plus the District of Columbia, and the leagues and teams becoming part of this, you know, ecosystem as stakeholders, I think we have to really address sports betting as a topic within sports law on a more regular basis. And this is a good reason why. I mean, this is a nascent industry that at several junctures may have gone off the rails and may be in need of even more regulation. And now, you know, the worst case scenario could potentially happen with Major League Baseball and more players being swept up in betting scandals. So all on the surface, you know, promotional bonuses and Yasiel Puig may seem like two ships passing in the night. They're really interconnected stories because the growth of the sports betting industry in the United States is basically going to, you know, maybe create more temptations for athletes to wager. We've seen that with Calvin Ridley and some of the suspensions in the National Football League. And as millions of more, you know, citizens and Americans and people throughout the country are wagering, they're taking advantage of these promotional bonuses and beginning to bet more heavily and more frequently. So these are two of the sort of what I consider the consequences, for better or for worse, of the expanded legalization of sports betting in the United States. Even though the Puig case involved illegal offshore betting, we can certainly envision more athletes wagering on games as sports wagering becomes more broadly legal. So I think they're perfect bookends for a sports betting themed episode.
Calvin Ridley, Yasiel Puig, maybe there are more, Dan. We will see. And if there are, we will certainly be the ones to be talking about them over here. For more of Conduct Detrimental, make sure you subscribe. And in this holiday giving season, make sure you share it with a friend. If you are interested in the stuff we are saying, we are an independent show. So word of mouth is the best way to spread our platform. Dan, I think that'll do it for all of us here at Conduct Detrimental. We will see you next time. Another episode of Conduct Detrimental.